The F Word at Work from Fertility Matters at Work is a conversation about fertility and how it affects people at work. You'll be hearing from our community about what they experienced whilst trying to build their families, as our aim is to help you better understand this issue by sharing these stories, along with our own insights from the work we are doing. Plus, we'll be talking to the organisations making these cultural changes the norm, as well as bringing you thought leaders from the workplace wellbeing space.
People don't feel comfortable disclosing because their organisation doesn't recognise it in a policy or a conversation or as something that needs support. And so they're not talking to their organisation and the organisation doesn't know it's a problem. So it's kind of like this cycle that's happening, and in the middle is just a void. And so if organisations are to take that first step and say, we recognise that people will be going through this, here's what we're going to do to support, that then almost takes that onus on, should I disclose? You can then decide, I can disclose, I know that I can talk to my employer. It kind of removes that unknown of what the response will be.
We're delighted that Apricity is sponsoring this series of The F Word at Work. Apricity is the world's first virtual fertility clinic. They use at-home testing and scans, which means just 2 in-person meetings per treatment, compared to around 10 with the traditional model. Apricity's fertility benefit gives end-to-end support and treatment from Apricity doctors and nurses and transparent pricing with no hidden costs. To find out about the unique Apricity fertility benefit and how they can support your employees with inclusive fertility care, to find out more, please get in touch with the Apricity team by going to apricityfertility.com and clicking on the For Employers section. Now on with the show.
All of last year, we launched our F Word at Work series because we are very passionate here at Fertility Matters at Work in sharing stories, because we feel it's such an essential way for you to really get an understanding of what people are going through. And we've got an amazing community who have been willing to share their stories so far. And we were doing that with our regular F Word at Work lunch and learns, like the one you're joining today. But because we know how you like to consume content in many different ways, we thought that a brilliant way for it to reach even more people would be to get into their ear holes and repurpose it as a podcast. So the F Word at Work podcast was launched last November. It's a combination of the brilliant stories that we've shared to date on the F Word at Work, but it's also best practice from some of the clients that we're working with here at Fertility Matters at Work. And also we've got some really interesting thought leadership conversations there. So like I say, I will share it in a moment, but just a thank you for your time. Fertility Matters at Work is here to help you understand more about the impact of fertility issues in the workplace, and ideally implement what's needed to help that conversation along. So we provide training, and we also provide more awareness raising events and a brilliant resource library that you can use internally, which I'm going to tell you a little bit more at the end, because without further ado, I'm going to hand over to my colleague Becky Cairns, who's going to speak more with our guests.
Thank you, Natalie, and welcome everyone. I'm delighted to have 2 amazing guests today, both of which have so generously agreed to share their stories with you. And I think it's going to be a really powerful session. So we often talk about how we bring this story to life through personal stories. And I think it is through hearing what somebody has gone through on a very complex path to parenthood, you can really start to realise the impact that it can have, particularly in the workplace. And today, we're focusing specifically on the experiences of people in heterosexual couples facing infertility and loss, and people working in very senior roles at the time of going through this as well. So just to set the context, and we will be featuring more and more stories of different paths to parenthood as we go through this year. So thank you to Madeline and thank you to Brendan for joining us today. I'm going to start with Madeline. And just to say before we begin, if you do have any questions at all as we go through, Natalie's going to be manning a Q&A box, so do pop them in there as and when they come to you. But Madeline, thank you so much for sharing your story. And we met last year, didn't we? So I'll let you introduce yourself properly in a moment. But I remember you contacted us and you were kind of really interested in the work we were doing and was really keen to start sharing your story as well. So I'll hand over to you just to introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about yourself.
Thank you. So I'm Madeline Macy, I'm 42. I've been working in luxury communications for 20 years. And most recently was the chief marketing officer and creative director at Liberty, big shop in London. And my fertility journey has spanned almost double figures, which makes me feel a little bit anxious, but really it has almost gone on that long. So I feel that I've probably experienced every permutation of what a fertility journey could be, apart from egg donation. That's really the span. So thank you for inviting me to be part of it. And why I contacted you is because so much of this happens in a man and woman's life when they're in their peak time in their career. So you really experience it while at work. And that's inescapable. And I certainly did from my first month at Liberty. So certainly my last 6 years of that part of my journey was all at work. So hopefully I can share something that will help people going through the same thing or companies wondering how they could support their team better.
Thank you, Madeline. I know you're really keen to really get that conversation out there. And I actually joined you at Liberty October time last year, where you sat down with the team at Liberty and so bravely shared your story for the first time with them. And it was quite an emotional experience, wasn't it?
It was really hard. So I'm used to standing up in front of hundreds of people and just talking. And that's something that I think I'm actually quite good at because I've got over the fear of doing it. It's the scariest thing when you share your own journey and your own experiences with people, and certainly people who you work with, who, you know, in one hand, you are in a leadership role and you're steering the ship and you're looking after your team and they have their own struggles that you support, to then say, I'm hurting and I'm vulnerable as well. My fear was, mistakenly, that you risk losing some of your authority. But actually what you gain is integrity. And so, yes, I was a bit of a blubbering wreck, if I was really honest. I mean, you were there. So I just started crying, and because it was just so much that had been pent up for so long that I kept from my work colleagues for so many years. And the response was extraordinary. I mean, I still get messages from people who worked on the shop floor that maybe I'd only kind of passed once or twice, I didn't have a particular interaction with, were sending me personal messages saying how important they've been to them. So again, I encourage people to, if they can and if they want to share their experiences, because it can help.
Yeah, there can be so much power in sharing our stories. And I think particularly leading through showing vulnerability as well. It's showing that you're human and you're going through these experiences too. It was such a privilege to be a part of that conversation, because I could just really feel in the room, people were connecting with you on a whole other level. And actually, I think I could always feel the relief coming from you as well in terms of sharing that story and being able to talk about, well, what is really a difficult time. And hopefully know that will then in turn help somebody else.
Well, this is only the second time I've talked about it, so
both times with me.
Yeah, exactly, you're my anchor.
I'm happy to be that. So Madeline, I know it's so hard to condense what has been a really, really long journey into a few paragraphs, sentences. Could you share with us what your experience has been to date, with as much as you're comfortable sharing?
Yeah, absolutely. So it was interesting because I knew you wanted me to do this. And so I have a chronological journey of what happened and where I've got to now. But actually, even today, a young girl who I work with, who hopefully is on this call, shared with me that she just had a miscarriage and it was her first one. And I actually don't want to start at the beginning, because I don't want people in that boat to think that they're necessarily going to be on the same very, very long path that I am, because it's not always the case. Mm-hmm. And so I don't want people to take my journey as a lack of hope, because that's not what it is. So more recently, I've been diagnosed with a fairly controversial diagnosis of something called natural killer cells. I mean, what a name. Whoever decided
the terminology,
very low EQ, but it's called natural killer cells. So essentially, my immune system tries to rid the body of anything that's alien. And of course, what could be more alien than actually trying to grow another life form? So, and of course, your immune system gets stronger and stronger every time it experiences something. And therefore, my body's just got better and better and better at expelling things. So that's why it's taken very long to get to that process. And I've had multiple losses along the way and that have become earlier and earlier all the time. But it also was quite difficult for me to get pregnant. So in the very beginning, it was really hard to fall pregnant. And that took me quite a long time. And I tried everything that was available, that was alternative medicine, which, by the way, I really believe in, but alternative medicine through to real medication, through to, you know, artificial insemination, and all the way to try and actually become pregnant. So I have multiple layers to my journey. So becoming pregnant to start with, and actually just learning about your body is so important. Whether I'd forgotten everything I learned at school, whether I didn't listen, or probably we weren't
taught. I don't think we were taught it.
I don't think we were taught. Actually, it's quite an important time to learn about how we function biologically as human beings, and it's fascinating. So anyway, I finally fell pregnant with my son, Maximilian, and it was a very, very difficult pregnancy because since obviously we've learned my immune system is trying to get rid, it was very hard, very small. He was induced very early. Because he just wasn't growing. So that was incredibly stressful. But he's now a very healthy 8-year-old boy. And that's all good news. But we loved being parents and we really wanted a brother or sister for Maxi. So we embarked again on the journey. And that's where, again, went through quite a lot of treatments to try and become pregnant, finally did. And then I lost that baby in my first month at Liberty in my brand new job. And Liberty was my something. I mean, what an incredible job, what an incredible place. And I really wanted to prove myself, as we all do when we start a new role. And I'd also embarked on some pushing the company to do new things. So running a photo shoot in-house for our brand. And then also we hosted a runway show inside Liberty during Fashion Week. And both of those things stupidly landed on the same week. And it was the week I was having a miscarriage. So there was absolutely no way I couldn't go into work. So I just carried on through it. And it's amazing what we are capable of as human beings. You can kind of just reach inside you and just pull out the ability to like force yourself forward. And it really is quite remarkable how we're able to do this. But I did. And it definitely had a longer term effect because I held everything back and was powering through and I can do this. Da, 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 da. Anyway, so unfortunately, it wasn't my first miscarriage and it wasn't my first miscarriage at work.
And my next question was going to be, how did it impact you at work? So,
Well, I didn't tell anyone. And it was a conscious decision. Because when you're at work and when you're a woman at work, and I was already fairly senior when I went in there as a marketing director, I also didn't want my company to think I was thinking about leaving, that I was thinking about having a family, because that's immediately something that feels like it could be, I should say, not every company, not automatically, and not at Liberty, in fact. But my kind of social acceptance was, trying for a family, trying for a baby means you're not that interested in work and you're going to take some time out. And that isn't the impression that I wanted to give. So at that stage, it wasn't so much about a choice of not wanting to look vulnerable. It was a choice of wanting people to take me seriously. So I didn't tell anybody. And again, that has a knock on. So because I've since had two miscarriages at work, what happened when gets a little bit confused. But the hardest thing I found was other pregnant people around me. Because when your friends are pregnant, that's hard. Okay, that is hard. But you don't see them every day. You know, when you are on the same floor, and I think it was my second, and I had two girls who revealed, oh, we're pregnant. Oh, how funny, we're pregnant at the same time. Yeah. And I could work out that actually I would have been pregnant at the same stage.
Yeah.
So at their 12 weeks, when they announced it, it would have been my 12 weeks. So I actually tracked their entire pregnancy, knowing that's where I would have been. And that was galling. Now, in your friends, you don't have that in the same way. So that's something at work that I think is really, really difficult, is mentioning your kind of your ghost pregnancy. And it's hard because I also don't want to turn around to girls who are so excited as they should be for their first baby, et cetera, and say, can you not talk about it, please? Can you be a little bit more sensitive? You know, that's quite hard. So you have to create coping mechanisms of your own. But it would be great if there was, which is what you do, is sort of training managers in training people in a sensitive way of how to deal with these things, rather than me being like, I can't make your baby shower. Sorry, I've got a hair appointment. Well, you know, you're like, you just get out there as much as you can. Yeah.
So tell us about you, because obviously you then went through IVF and how was that with working at the same time? I think, was this around the time of the pandemic, I believe?
It was. So this is still before the diagnosis of the immune issue. And we're getting older now, you know, and wanting to speed it up. Yeah. So, and I didn't want to again go through all the different rigmarole of all the different medications, et cetera. So let's do IVF. Let's speed this process up. I'm turning 40 soon. And it's something I had resisted for a while, and partly because it takes so much of your time. Like, it's a dedication. You have to dedicate yourself to IVF because of the changes to your body, because of the diet, because of the time that you have to allow for your blood tests, for your scans, all of these things. So again, I still am telling people at work. That's still a decision that I'm living with. And retrospectively, I shouldn't have, but I did. So how do I do that? Thank goodness the pandemic came up. Now, to start with, you still can do IVF at the beginning. And then it's sort of like, I could do whatever I liked in the timing that I wanted, and nobody was checking and nobody knew. And I could Teams in on calls just before, just after. And it worked. And I didn't have to tell people what I was going through. And I chose not to. Again, I don't know why, but that I did, because you just don't talk about it. So that's why we're here, breaking the taboos. Let's talk about this. So it was a relief. And I ended up doing 3 rounds.
And it's really interesting that you say that, because that really reflects the research we did during that time. So we asked people, how was it going through treatment whilst working during the pandemic? And it was 83% said that they found it easier. And that was because it was easier to hide, anecdotally. So you can see how flexibility, working from home, all of these things that we say are really good, reasonable adjustments to make for somebody, can really make a difference to that person, rather than having to, if you're not physically having to be there, it's so much easier. And obviously that's if your role allows that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But if your role allows that, but then if you have the support of your, and the commitment of your peers, and again, the leadership team, you can organize time off, you know, to work around it. And also things like, my friends knew I was going through IVF. My work colleagues didn't. And because I'm in a leadership role and I have a whole team below me, I was in the waiting room for one of my blood tests for IVF. And I had one of my girls on my team call me to tell me she was pregnant. Now, that's what you do, because she needs to tell me this. But had I actually shared I was going through it, maybe she would have planned it a little differently, because that's hard. That's hard. You're like on the phone, like, are you kidding me? It's difficult. Mm-hmm. So it's that sensitivity as well that's incredibly important.
Yeah. And that's one of the things we try to raise awareness of, the impact of these triggering events like a pregnancy announcement. And it's not that people aren't happy for you. It's just that it can really impact you when you're in the thick of it and you're struggling. And we often say that, look, if you can send a text when somebody is in a safe space, just to give them a heads up beforehand so they can have their emotional reaction, then that's so much easier than having to, because someone described it as, it's almost like you've been punched in the stomach, but you're expected to give this really happy face straight away and not show. And then you feel guilty, don't you? Because you feel bad for feeling some sadness.
And you know, the thing is, we know people say the wrong thing. Most of the time they say the wrong thing, but it doesn't come from a bad place. It comes from a lack of the tools or the knowledge to know what the right thing to say is, or the right way to respond and behave. So again, that's why breaking down the taboos is so important, to have these conversations, to stop being, I had a conversation with myself quite early on in this journey to not be bitter, because it's so easy to fall into that. And I really checked myself, because people saying the wrong thing, stuff getting thrown at you, you're like, I need to respond in the right way as well. And that's a lesson, because so much of this is, if you look at the positive of it, so much of it is life lessons of how to deal with things that are really hard. And that's okay, because that's growth. You know, I'm such a better person for the amount of shit I've dealt with. I'm much nicer, for sure, and stronger. So, you know, there are goods to take from this, but I do think people are looking for the tools. They are looking to be equipped. They want to say the right, just don't know how.
Yeah. And so did you eventually talk to your manager, to your boss, to anybody in the organisation?
I did. So my third miscarriage, I have a wonderful boss. He's very, very human. And my HR director is a real friend. So I just shared everything and they were wonderful. But again, it's my private story, so they're not going to share it on my behalf.
Yeah.
And in fact, my HR director came up to me, and this is still quite, all of this for me is very, very new. So my HR director came up to me and said, listen, there is a girl who is struggling with IVF at work, and she's having to go into meetings that are quite hard about finance and budgets, etc. And she's struggling because her home life is so wobbly and her hormones are all over the place. And I just think it'd be helpful for her to know you've done this too. And I was like, yeah, sure. We went out for lunch. And I just shared my story, and she was so grateful, and it meant so much to her. I suddenly realized I was reneging on my responsibilities. Actually, I have a duty of care. I really look after my team and the people I work with. But I was neglecting that, which was actually so fundamentally important to not just the people immediately and that I could influence, but actually in a larger group. So, which is why I'm here, and the hope that saying all of this blurb in not a very succinct way is helpful to someone who might be listening.
No, it's a beautiful human way, and you're just telling the story and how it feels, and that's why we have these conversations. And you're highlighting so many things as you're talking around kind of that importance of having that peer-to-peer support as well, and just having somebody who gets it to be able to talk about it with. And that's another thing we encourage organizations to try and foster once you've opened up the conversation. And what we often find is that domino effect, isn't it, like we mentioned earlier, where people suddenly they can see somebody who gets it, someone they can speak to, and it can make such a difference to somebody on that journey. So Madeline, tell us kind of where you're at the moment, if you're comfortable to. And
so there are going to be people on this call in all different stages of their journey, and I've had to check myself several times to be like, am I being obsessive? Like, have we just got to the point where this is an obsession and you need to wave the white flag and say enough? And there are several times that I've had that thought and spoken with my husband about that too, because of course it's a partnership, which is why it's so wonderful that Brendan's here as well. So it's definitely a partnership. We both really want this. And at the beginning, I wanted it for a sibling for Maxie. But as we've now established, this is like 7 years ago now. Now it's about, we really want another child in our life. We want to give an amazing home to somebody. And I want to make sense of all the loss. Personally, I want to make sense of those babies that flew away. This is why we did it. So we move on. I went through a journey of also having to recognize I can't carry. And as soon as I was okay with that, that didn't happen fast for me. That took, I think, another lockdown and like hiking every day in Devon. Like that was how I got to this realization. And I was able to let that go. And we're looking at surrogacy and not looking at it. We're doing it. We started looking at surrogacy. And actually, when I suddenly decided that I was going to stop putting myself through this, because I mean, I was really depressed for a period, like properly depressed. That's bad for Maxie. That's bad for our relationship. That's bad for, and weirdly, I was fine at work. No one knew. So I was like, I was absolutely fine. Yeah. Go home.
Put the face on.
I put on the face. I went home and I wasn't even talking to my son. Like there was a point I was so low, I couldn't even read him a bedtime story. I was like, done. And I thought, I can't, this is not a life. So surrogacy is the next part of our journey. And I was like, take this from me, you incredible woman, please. I've ridded myself with this. I can't bear it anymore. Thank you. So it's been actually a weight off my shoulders that I no longer have to fight my own self so much.
Yeah.
So unfortunately, our surrogacy journey has not been that straightforward or short. So we are now 18 months in and on our second surrogate. But we have two embryos left. Two embryos left. So we had another miscarriage, which feels unbelievably unfair when you go through all of that and you choose a surrogate to work with because they're not me, and it still happens. But you know, that's just because you cannot control this process. And if you think you can, you're going to do yourself a disfavor. You cannot control what is going on. And this is nature we're dealing with, and nature cannot be tamed. And that's actually also what's so wonderful about it, even though it's also miserable. So we have two left. We're going to be working with the same girl, and we're going to try again, because hope is stronger than despair. So we're going to keep going.
Thank you, Madeline. And I know this is still really raw for you and difficult to talk about. And I just want to say, if anybody's listening and you're finding some of the topics difficult, then do, if you need to step away, this is going to be recorded so you can always come back to it. I think, Madeline, you've just highlighted there the very real grief that comes with this and that impact to mental health as well, which I think when you're trying to hold down a job and you're trying to, it takes all of your energy just to keep that down whilst you're at work and carry on. And so did you ever have any kind of instances at work where that did come up, you had to leave, or were you able to kind
of yes, and I encourage it. Walk away.
Yes.
You don't need to sit through it. Walk away. I mean, that is totally fine. Also, you know, work is a wonderful distraction. If you love what you do, and I do love what I do, and the people you're with. There's wonderful energy that can come from it. So definitely take time off, like take time off. And if your work doesn't have or doesn't recognize miscarriage as a bereavement or doesn't have a sick day, have three, just take time off, right? You need it. But then go back, because you do not want to wallow in it. It is not good for you. And actually, work can be really rewarding as well. So yeah. I don't want to discredit the good that work can bring.
Yeah. And I think work is a huge part of our identity, isn't it? And I think going through something like this can really have that impact on who you are as a woman and what you can do as a woman. And I remember myself finding that really, really difficult at work, but I didn't want to leave my job because that was a huge part. I've worked for it. And I think in some ways, there's so much you talked about the loss of control and the uncertainty, that if work can be that constant and that support for you, that allows you an outlet and allows you to still be you whilst you're going through this experience.
Incredibly important. Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you so much, Madeline. Sure. I really appreciate it. And I will come back to you. And if anyone does have any questions, please do pop them in the Q&A. I'm going to move over to Brendan now. And Brendan reached out to me after I did a webinar with WITL, which is Women in Hospitality, Travel and Leisure, back in January. And I think Brendan listened in and it resonated as we were talking about fertility journeys in the workplace. And Brendan reached out. And I must tell you, it's very rare to have a male reach out and want to share their stories. I jumped and I saw Brendan's email and had a conversation and was just really delighted that from a male perspective, we can hear that the impact that this journey can also have. You may not be the one predominantly going through the treatments, but you're very much on that journey as well. So thank you so much, Brendan, for joining. And just want to hand over to you just to introduce yourself and your role, and then we'll move on to your story.
Yeah, thanks, Becky. And yeah, I never thought I would have been here discussing this sort of topic in this forum. So I've discussed it a few times, not necessarily my second, but you know, I'm not an expert either. So bear with me. I'm the group treasurer at Compass Group. I think, you know, Compass is a people organization. We employ over 500,000 people globally. So, you know, people are really at the center and the heart of this organization. So it's another reason why I sort of wanted to sort of connect. And, you know, I'll do whatever I can on this side to help formulate whether it's a fertility policy or just get the debate going internally here, because I do feel passionately about it. I've done finance all of my career. I'm a chartered accountant by background. I've worked in four different organizations through our fertility journey. That's how long it's been going on. So, you know, sort of seen a number of different sectors, different organizations, different bosses, different peers, colleagues, and everything else sort of throughout this journey. So if you want, I'll give you a sort of the short sort of summary of how we've got here. It's been a long and challenging journey, I have to say. I'll try and condense it as much as I can. My wife and I have been married 20 years this year. She did fall pregnant naturally about 4 years after we were married. We were living in Austria at the time, working in Austria. We lost the baby about 16 weeks with complications. And it was pretty traumatic, I have to say, because, you know, you just expect everything will go smoothly. It was kind of such a traumatic event. It really sort of accelerated my departure from that organization, just because out of the country, you're away from your friends and family. It's difficult enough to deal with. You know, so my first really experience of how this can actually influence people in their career choices if they're not supported. There was zero support, to my knowledge. And in fact, in all of the organizations I've worked, I do not recall this topic of fertility being on anyone's agenda. So, you know, that's why I'm sort of happy to sort of help promote this. So, you know, so accelerating our move, we were planning to move back to the UK. And as it happened, the best job opportunity that came up at the time was in the Middle East. So we moved directly from Austria to Dubai. And my wife had a medical procedure after the sort of termination. And that was really sort of where things started to go wrong from an inability to conceive perspective.
Yeah.
So, you know, we looked into IVF. We did two rounds of IVF at a clinic in Sharjah. It was terrible. I mean, the clinic, the infrastructure, the environment, the lack of support, the environment was awful. We persevered for a couple of occasions without success. And then you think, start to get, you know, sort of anxious. Time passes, as time is passing on and everything else. So we switched over to a clinic in London. So my wife was working part time. So it was somewhat easier than, you know, being in a full time executive role and having to sort of step out so she could come back and forth for treatment. But I didn't really want to sort of send her by herself back to the UK to go to the clinic and have injections and all that. So I did whatever I could to come back whenever I could to support her through it. You know, we did 3 cycles in the UK without success. Now you're starting to think this isn't going to happen, frankly. I then changed jobs again, you know, sort of my own choice to move back to the UK. And I was a group treasurer at AstraZeneca before this role. That's the job I came back to the UK to do. We then tried egg donation. So we did 3 rounds of IVF at a clinic in Spain. The clinic was excellent, but yeah, despite going that route, another 3 sort of failed attempts. So 8 IVF cycles my wife went through, all with failure in total. Resonate with what Madeline was saying about you have to come to the office, you have to be present, you have to manage the team, manage issues, a lot of issues in my world through that sort of period of time. Everybody, you know, lots of people in the team, in the company, friends, family falling pregnant, you know, that's the sort of natural age for it to happen, right? That's what we're in. And I certainly gripe every time at feeling like a punch in the stomach. So that's where we got to. I joined Compass in beginning of 2018, and just over a year later, a chance encounter with a couple on a boat in Thailand on holiday. It literally was that, who said, we're sat on this boat and the 2 of us and the 2 of them and the 2 little kids. And you said, oh, you're here by yourself, no kids. And we just kind of got into this sort of story a little bit. And the lady sort of very unobtrusively just came down, found us out in the hotel the next day and just sort of slipped the card. They said, look, if you're interested, my friends have just been through surrogacy and they have now a little boy. If you're interested, here are the details. That's how the next stage, our journey happened. And the clinic they mentioned was in Boston. By coincidence, 2 weeks after our holiday, I was on a business trip in Boston. So I made an appointment. I went down at 7 a.m. in the morning or 6:30 in the morning before business hours and met. I said, I wanted to check this thing exists. I know nothing about this. It just literally came completely cold. I didn't know anything about the process. So I went and sat with them. They explained it. And I thought, this could help. This could be a solution for us. And, you know, went home excited, talked to my wife about it. And she wasn't on the same page yet. She hadn't given up wanting to do this herself yet, but worth exploring. So it took a while from there. I mean, that was probably April 2019. The time we got on board, signed up, got registered and understood enough about it to start it off, we were booked to go to the US the last week of March 2020 to start this process. And of course, you know what happened then?
Yeah.
So that put us on the back burner yet again. We did manage to sort of make progress during lockdown. And on the one hand, it was another stress to have, but on the other hand, it was another motivation to have during lockdown. So the long and the short of it, we got a match with a surrogate. We all agreed to proceed in the US and we got cracking with the logistics, albeit remotely, at expense and complexity to get organized. And unfortunately, first attempt failed, second attempt failed, third attempt failed. And then we had another sort of very unpleasant sort of decision to make to change surrogate, which we did. So we're now into sort of 2021. Got a second match with a surrogate. And all throughout these processes, there was no sort of obvious reason why something hadn't worked out. You know, it's not as if, this has happened or it's some deficiency or it's a low-grade embryo or all this sort of stuff. It was just no one could really figure out why it didn't work out. First attempt with our second surrogate also failed. So that's 12 attempts now between us and our surrogate. We were pretty much down to the end of our sort of emotional resilience, I have to say. And from a practical point of view, we were pretty much down to the last sort of selection of embryos we had. So in December 21, we decided against kind of the recommendation of most people to transfer 2 embryos as a second attempt. And sort of just before Christmas 2021, we get a call from our surrogate who said, I'm pregnant. You know, so can you imagine it? How it sort of planned out? You know, give all the history. This is too good to be true. This can't sort of continue. But, you know, call it luck, serendipity, whatever you like. From that point on, the pregnancy was textbook, very, very smooth. And this sort of amazing woman, you know, gave birth to twins for us last August, 38 weeks, perfectly healthy. So, you know, I think a 14-year journey to get there. And as I say, a lot of ups and downs and a lot of emotion and a lot of heartache along the way, but that was the outcome. So that's the journey in a nutshell.
Thank you for sharing that. I get quite emotional just hearing all of that, Brendan. Just the, just the amount of things you had to go through and process, and not just keep trying the same thing, but have to then get your head around different paths. So egg donation, surrogacy, all things that aren't easy decisions to make and come with a whole lot of grief around it as well, and misunderstanding. And I suppose from both yours and Madeline's story, navigating surrogacy from speaking with people isn't an easy thing to navigate either, particularly when you're doing it abroad. So how did you find balancing that with work as well?
Well, at the start, this was bewildering. And I remember the first couple of articulations of what it was, and the parties and the framework, et cetera, was bewildering. And I think I'm right in saying that the only two countries where surrogacy is regulated and there's a legal framework for it is the US and the Ukraine. Ukraine obviously had, you know, had its own sort of tragic sort of examples that you read in the press at the time of the invasion a couple of years ago. We chose to do it in the US. So again, a totally unfamiliar sort of legal framework for us as well. I didn't understand any of it to start with. So it took a long time to get comfortable with it. It's expensive. There's no two ways around it. You know, IVF in the US is expensive. Surrogacy is expensive. Medical bills in the US is expensive. Insurance in the US, medical insurance for a pregnant surrogate is a nightmare. We ran a very uncomfortable risk, I have to say. And, you know, financial risk management is what I do. And I was personally pretty uncomfortable with this. We couldn't get insurance. Had a baby's been born prematurely, which is entirely normal, impossible for twins in the US, and been in the NICU for any period of time, the bill would have been hundreds of thousands of dollars before we knew it. We had a one-night hospital stay, which cost $6,500, and there was nothing wrong with them, just to put some context around it. So it's expensive, it's challenging. I mean, from a time perspective, I knew at some point, if this sort of all proceeded, that I would need to take a sort of chunk of time out of the office, a good chunk of time to you know, to want to be there in the US, and you can't immediately come home and everything else. So I've been accruing holiday, extra holiday, with the express permission of my boss, or successive bosses in Compass at least, to say, look, at some point this might happen, I might need to take an extended break. And everyone was totally cool with that. And it took to the question you asked, the sort of Madeline, in terms of who we'd spoken to, our family, our friends, our colleagues, nobody knew we were doing that, any of this, the whole process, not even our family knew. It was just me and my wife, kind of against the world, it felt, you know, when you're going through all these setbacks. So you come the point, and the only person I had always kept in touch with, my boss, and on all occasions I found them to be hugely sort of supportive, you know, emotionally, and just said, look, do whatever you need to do. And I would sort of just sort of flag that, you know, I've been lucky. I always work for the group CFO, so, you know, executive director, who's had the autonomy to sort of gift that flexibility. In this conversation, I think it's worth recognizing that, because you could certainly see a situation where, you know, big company, rigid policies, middle manager, that's a totally different discussion to the one that I was able to have, and that sort of flexibility on timing. But in the end, we spent 3 months in California last summer, started my working day at 3 or 4 a.m. So I had an overlap with the team in the UK at least half the day, and then took an extended break after they were born, and, you know, with the good grace of Compass, you know, so it's a good experience from the my side, with the company being sort of supportive of, you know, what was challenging for me.
Yeah, I'm glad you raised that point, because I wanted to pull out, obviously, both yourself and Madeline are in senior roles, and with that, you are potentially able to flex a little bit more if you're able to speak with your manager. There's more kind of opportunity, and I can see Madeline nodding as well. And so thinking about your experiences and thinking about people who might not be in that same position. So if we're thinking about Liberty, there's people who work on the shop floor and work in particular hours. What do you think organisations can potentially do to support those at all levels of an organisation? So Madeline, I'll come to you first.
Well, I mean, that's why I came to you. I mean, but briefly, because it is definitely about awareness, about knowledge, and about having a family policy that has a broad scope. So what is the scope of that policy need to be? Which is what you're so brilliant at working with the HR teams to deliver and build. And then making sure that all the managers in place throughout the organization are aware of the breadth of it, aware that this is happening and what can be done to accommodate support, and definitely thinking about mental health. All of this stuff, it does dovetail together, because of course mental health comes with all of this, and there are mental health, something's been talked about quite rightly for quite a while now, so those things are already in the policy. So how everything kind of works together, yeah, just to be tightened up and understood throughout.
Yeah, I think what you're saying, that it's having that cultural shift, isn't it? So that there's that awareness and education, so that at all levels that can be applied. I don't know whether you'd add anything to that, Brendan.
No, I totally agree. There needs to be people who understand it, who've been properly trained in it, understand the terminology, what the process is and what it isn't. You know, whether that's sort of vanilla IVF, if there is such a thing, or surrogacy, because I know from when I started these processes, I understood nothing. So you can't assume just because somebody is a HR professional, for want of a better description, that they also understand it. And to be able to have is somebody you can have the conversation with who gets it and understands it, really understands it, would be really helpful. And if I'd known that support existed internally, I would have been comfortable having the discussion. You know, people were helpful and flexible and supportive of me, definitely, and all the times I've discussed it. But that's not the same as having somebody who really understands the process. And there is a lot of misunderstanding about this, for sure.
Yeah,
I like the point you were talking about, or Madeline was talking about you know, an internal sort of network as well, because this is a relatively small office that I'm in here, call it 350 people. By definition, there's going to be other people who are going through this journey. Yeah. You know, maybe they don't want to connect, but if they do, then knowing there are other people around, you can sort of, you know, just have a coffee with them or put an arm around them or just sort of share their experience might be a helpful thing. Yeah. Creating those networks, or even, you know, cross company, but we ought to be able to do more internally, for sure.
Yeah, definitely. There are the people out there who are going through this. And I think it's important to say, what we don't say is everyone has to share and has to disclose. It should be a personal choice. But I think at the minute people are choosing not to because they don't feel like they've got that option to. And so it's that opening up that safe space for people to feel comfortable to. And just before we come to any questions, if anyone's got any questions, please pop them in the Q&A box. Brendan, I just want to touch on, obviously, I mentioned earlier, we don't hear from many men who are talking about their experiences. And why do you think that is, that men aren't talking about this as much as women?
There's the male stereotype, which is clearly a factor here. I think it is a very sort of personal thing, isn't it? I mean, would I be sat here sort of telling all of this if I hadn't, you know, ultimately been successful with the end game, or whether I'd still be sort of sulking and licking my wounds and saying, well, didn't work out for us? I don't know. I can't answer that question. But if I'm being honest about it, I think it would have been a lot harder to be here having this discussion without ultimately being sort of successful. And I think, you know, you're hurting yourself, you know, every time you get a sort of a setback. My wife is hurting every time, and you know, every time everyone else announces they're pregnant, the same thing. So you're trying to sort of look after yourself and look after your home. That takes a huge amount of your resilience to then want to sort of share this externally. And, you know, in our case, not want to tell anybody about this, and therefore not wanting the pressure of somebody else saying, well, was it successful? You know, let me know. I'm interested to find out. No, it wasn't successful. You know, it's just like, neither of us, we're both completely aligned that we don't want to do that. So it wasn't as if my wife wanted to tell the world and I was on the other side saying, well, I don't want to tell anybody. We were pretty well aligned on that. But, you know, as you said before, this is different for everyone. Some people will be comfortable sharing with it. And I can certainly see, you know, if somebody said, well, I've been trying to get pregnant, I'm now trying IVF, excited, you're assuming it's going to work. First time, maybe, but two or three times later, that weight of expectation from others asking questions would be, you know, something you could do without, I think.
Yeah. And we hear that a lot from people that don't want to disclose because I don't want to have to inform everyone every time at every step of how things have gone. And that's why, as part of our education, we talk about the let that person lead. Don't keep asking how are things going, but let them know that you're there if they need you. And so it is that element of trying to balance those questions with support. Madeline, did you?
Yeah, I just wanted to add, so my most recent miscarriage was actually only 2 weeks ago with our surrogate. So that's very fresh. But what was different this time is I told a lot of people we were doing this. I was completely the opposite to Brendan I don't mean just me, it's just my husband as well. Tactic was just to tell everybody because I was over silent grief. Mm. I wanted a hug. I wanted people to know what was going on. When she fell pregnant, everyone was excited for us because, you know, it was a wonderful moment we all shared and it was great. And then when it went wrong, I have never had such amazing response, like just so much love and so much. And it helps. I mean, it really, really helps. You need a hug. And even my cleaner, she like got me some daffodils and put them outside the door, you know, just like, it's just so lovely. And you need it. So I don't turn away from people being sweet because certainly, you know, early miscarriage, you don't talk about it until 12 weeks, which I think is just utter, but that's something for another conversation. You get a lot. So,
yeah.
On the counter.
And I'm so grateful for you being here today, Madeline, because I know it's been a difficult couple of weeks for you. We have had a question that's been asked, so I'm just going to read it. It's from Amy. Surely a best practice for employers would be to have a policy based on the fact women don't want to disclose this. In a way, no different than health and safety for women in the first trimester who don't disclose. 1 out of 13 women in their 30s are pregnant at any given time. What would the equivalent stat be for women trying IVF or having miscarriage? So we know fertility treatment affects 1 in 7 individuals and pregnancy loss is 1 in 4 pregnancies. So the stats are huge. So I guess what I'm saying is the onus shouldn't be on women to disclose. It should be on employers realizing at any given time, this could be affecting teams. And I completely agree. I think we're talking about almost like this cycle that people don't feel comfortable disclosing because their organization doesn't recognize it in a policy or a conversation or as something that needs support. And so they're not talking to their organization and the organization doesn't know it's a problem. So it's kind of like this cycle that's happening and in the middle is just a void. And so if organizations are to take that first step and say, we recognize that people will be going through this, here's what we're going to do to support. That then almost takes that onus on, should I disclose? You can then decide, I can disclose. I know that I can talk to my employer. It kind of removes that unknown of what the response will be. So I just wondered, it was more of a comment than a question really, but what would your thoughts be on that? So Brendan, what would you say to that thought around putting something out there and the onus being on the employer to signal?
In the 4 organisations I've worked for, which all, you know, sort of, big multinationals over this journey, and maybe that's sort of indicative of the fact that this goes back in time rather than, you know, looking forward from now. But, you know, none of them have had any sort of clarity on this. And if there were things in place, I never knew they existed, which means they weren't being communicated properly. So I think, yeah, absolutely. Having something out there that people are aware of and can tap into if they want, and having the requisite skills internally to be able to sort of cope and support with people would be a prerequisite. For this, you know, I'm not advocating a sort of a hard and fast policy or companies agreeing to pay for X, Y, and Z. That's not my place to sort of say in any case. But having thought about it and having the resources available internally is the key thing in making sure people know about it.
Thank you. And Madeline, any thoughts?
Well, I agree with everything you've said. I think choosing allies in the workplace, which is something that I did. I mean, the statement/question that the listener put forward, totally right. It's absolutely up to the company to make sure that they've taken this into account. But while they're doing that, I had some key people in my team, my right hand, that I did tell, and she was brilliant because I could then call her up and be like, I'm going in for another IV. Can you just cover me for the blah, blah, blah? You know, so there were allies that helped me through the IVF cycles. But you're right. And I am part of that as being a leadership person in the team. It's up to me to enforce it and to communicate it more and just say, this is a safe space to talk about, and then back it up with the reality of it.
Yeah. Thank you so much. We've just had one more question that's just been asked. So Charlotte has said, some employers are basing policies on a number of paid days leave per year, with any further absence being made up, such as through annual leave. What is your take on this when assisted reproduction is so complex and time consuming? And how do you think employers can strike a balance? And I suppose it's listening to stories like yours that have sort of spanned over a number of years. And what are your thoughts on that balance between kind of supporting through paid leave? And I know you're not speaking for your own personal organisation, but just as somebody who's been through it and thinking about people at different levels of the organisation, what difference could that make? Brendan, who do you mind sharing?
It's difficult. I mean, because you know, clearly no one would have ever written a policy which catered for, you know, the length and the complexity of what we've been through, either on my wife's side, if she was working, or me as a supporting spouse here. It is really difficult to be totally prescriptive about this. And I'll just give you a sort of another anecdote, which is not related to fertility, but it is related to sort of policy and the way companies enforce this. In my previous role, I was asked to sort of relocate, and, you know, the relocation didn't really sort of appeal, which is why I ended up, and actually why I ended up at Compass. But for a period of time, I had two parallel discussions going, one internally with relocation and one externally with Compass, which also involved some relocation. The organization I was working for was, well, we have a policy and we don't want to create any precedent, so we're not going outside the policy. I left that organization, and that was a sort of a very, very strong reason for my decision to move, because I had an alternative, in that case Compass, saying, yeah, we haven't looked at that before, but we'll be pragmatic and yeah, okay, fine, we'll do it. Quick decision outside a rigid policy. Now again, maybe that's worked because I was a senior employee, you know, bringing skills to the organization, and maybe that's not the right answer across the board here, but I would advocate against sort of totally rigid policies, because that, in my experience, having been through it, albeit in a different sort of context, it was a big turnoff.
Well, Brent, I was going to say almost something exactly to that point. There is a whole movement happening right now called conscious quitting. And people are choosing to leave their companies if they're ethical, environmental, all of these things that people are thankfully now really beginning to care about don't make the grade. This is a perfect example of that. Organizations have a responsibility to understand how the world is moving. And the people who are at the forefront of all of this are the millennial employees who are very demanding. They want change, they want difference, and they want their companies to meet their expectations of what an environmentally humanitarian company needs to be for them to work there. It's more important, if research is correct, than salary increases, because they're choosing to work there for a multitude of reasons. Yes. Now, more than ever, and I hope it's a trend that will continue, the ball is more in the employee's court. And Brendan's example is exactly one of that. I've got problems here and I'm choosing this one because it has a policy for family.
Yeah.
And I think it's that focus on the individual. And obviously you can't focus on all the different scenarios when it comes to situations like this, but it's having the guide within the policy to give a framework, but allowing that exceptional circumstances where things do go on, if there is possibility. Just to add, just before we close, because I know we're at 1:30, someone has also added, better if employees can offer paid leave per cycle rather than as an overall amount. And yeah, I'd agree with that, because I think I've seen policies where it says you get X number of days per year, but if you need to go through 4 or 5 cycles in a year, how do you wait till next year till you get more leave? And I think that could be helpful for some people. So yeah, there's a whole other debate there around paid leave, but I think what you said there, and I think what you alluded to there, Brendan, around actually people will make choices as well on whether or not their individual circumstances are taken into account, I think is really important. But I just want to close just by thanking both of you so much for your time and your generosity in sharing your stories. They are so powerful. And I think for those who are listening, we'll hopefully take away some positivity from them, but also kind of some learnings for their organisation as well. So thank you so much.
Absolute pleasure. And just to add, I mean, if anybody is thinking about surrogacy in an early stage and wants a perspective on it, put them in touch with me directly, and you know, my wife or myself would be happy to sort of share the ins and outs of our process. But, you know, it was a good one, I have to say. It was a good one, and our surrogate is now part of our family, and the family is part of our family.
Thank you, Brendan. I feel good that you two have connected. Thank you so much. I'm going to hand back over to Natalie to close.
Yeah, thank you, both of you, so much. I've been scribbling down notes. You've made amazing things for us to think about, I think, at Facility Matters at Work. And I just want to add, as well as a big thank you to you both, to anybody who is watching. There is a lot of information here and we've covered a lot of ground and we've talked about that importance of, for example, Brendan said about how if they understood at his place of work what that surrogacy journey looked like. And within our support and our membership resource, we have exactly that. We have workshops on demand discussing these alternative routes to parenthood. And that is why we're hoping that you joining us on conversations like this means that we can further the conversation. So I have put details of how you can get in touch with us in the chat. We won't keep you any longer because I know we've gone over the time, but we do hope we get to speak to you again. And thank you for your time today.
Do follow us on our socials at Fertility Matters at Work on Insta and LinkedIn and at Fertility Matters Work on Twitter. Plus, we've got lots of free resources to download at fertilitymattersatwork.com.